home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And here we are with another edition of Rated LGBT Radio. Garrett Miller is on hiatus after his very successful and very tiring December with his hit Christmas song, and he is out there working away right now. So it is left to me to cover us up tonight, and I have a fantastic guest. I'm so excited to talk to him. We've been trading Facebook messages and talking for a while about getting him on the show. And I'm actually quite in awe. This is a, by every account, a young man, and he has accomplished so much and is accomplishing so much as a filmmaker. And so without any further ado, let me bring him on. Alec Fisher, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No problem. That we're all connected. It's like, which for me, who's like the most technically inept person, that's amazing. You know, so here we go. So Alec, you, as I mentioned, you're like well on your way here with this, this pack of accomplishments that you're working on, and, you're barely legal to drink.
I mean, I've got 1 or 2 years on me for that one, but I mean, I'm 23 right now, so bit older than 21. Yeah,
you're so the Lifetime Achievement Award won't be feel as silly at 23 as it was to 21. Well, let's take you back because I want to talk about some of the amazing work that you've done, and I'll just touch on Minnesota Nice. I have to tell you, just the beginning of that film, by the time it got to the credits, I couldn't even see the screen anymore. My eyes had teared up. I was like so emotional. It was such a huge, huge impact film. But before we get into that, you actually started out trying to make some horror films in your younger days. How did that come about?
I did. My friends from middle school and high school have all been killed off in a number of ways because of that. So my parents were not too thrilled, but I ended up falling in love with film and digital video by taking a creative writing class, and I wrote a short horror skit there. And one of the assignments was to turn it into a different medium, and so I chose video. So made a, 8-minute horror film with some friends, put it together in a week or 2 weeks and presented it to the class, and watching their reactions to it and how, certain moments made them jump and certain moments made them, tense up, and they were involved. They were connected to this story I'd created. That sort of made me interested in exploring other methods of video and really telling stories in powerful ways. And so the horror films ended up leading to documentaries. So a little bit of an odd transition there, but that's how I started.
Yeah, dramatic horror to finding the subtle thread of horror in real life. Maybe that's a little overstated, but anyway, that's my PR spin for you. So now you are also in your bio, it talks about the Dalai Lama. Something about the Dalai Lama. What is that association?
Yeah, I was a Dalai Lama fellow while I was in college, which was a fellowship, a social change fellowship. So we were selected. It was a group of 15 to 16 students from around the world who were social entrepreneurs and who were making a difference in their communities. And we were given mentorship and support by the fellowship. And so we had a year-long fellowship project, and we're given grant money with that. So my project initially was a film and then ended up being pivoted towards having conversations with students about ethical development and ethical leadership in their lives and the role of being authentic as a college student and how that shows up in daily lives of your students that you see around the country. So that was sort of that moment in my life. And it was amazing. It was an incredible experience, and I'm really grateful that it happened.
So help me with this in just getting to the heart of you and where you have generated all of this fantastic work. So you started with kind of fascination film, playing with the horror genre, and which is kind of fun and, you know, dramatic and all that. But how did you connect with such a social consciousness? I mean, what drove you to want to make that kind of impact?
Yeah, I think it stemmed from, I experienced a lot of very harsh bullying in my middle school experience, and I had a lot of friends that bullied a lot around me. And we sort of stuck together as a unit. We didn't really find any adults that were there to assist us or help us in any way. So I ended up being the support system for a lot of those folks, and ended up realizing in high school that nobody was really talking about it in a real way that connected with students. And so from my own experience, that's what led me to make Minnesota Nice, which was the film I think you watched the first segment of. And I think for me, it really was reaching a point where I had looked around and I didn't see anyone talking about the issue that was key to my existence. I almost took my life as a middle schooler because of the bullying I was experiencing for being gay. At the time, I wasn't out, but it was something that everyone was perceiving about me. So that was something that stuck with me. And, I didn't see that support in our state. Minnesota at the time had one of the weakest bullying prevention laws in the country. And so that sort of was the inspiration behind it, is taking that real life experience, that real life horror that I was seeing and I experienced as a child, and really making that into something that could have an impact, and ended up having a large impact in not only the state, but around the world in different schools.
So tell me more about, so you went from middle school, sort of, and actually making the horror films actually even makes more sense now with, you know, needing that kind of venting outlet, you know, based on what was going on with you. So you went from that, and what was the steps? I mean, how did you turn that into, hey, I'm going to go make a film? And Minnesota Nice doesn't look like it was an easy film to make. I mean, you had quite a few people involved in a lot of people's stories. And I mean, that doesn't look easy. How did you set that up?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, and this is something I've heard a lot throughout my life, is I just did it. I had a passion for it. I had the motivation for it, and I wasn't really sure what to do, but I knew that I had to start doing something. And I think if I would have sat there and wondered where to start or what to do first, I think I would have never started. So I think the key for me was I just had a moment, end of my junior year of high school, where I was like, I just have to start making this. I don't really know how I'm going to make it, but I need to start it. So I took the camera equipment I had at the time and asked a couple friends from my school if I could interview them about their experiences being bullied, because I knew that they had gone through a lot alongside me. And a few of them are featured in the film. They made the final cut. But I started with that, and I learned what to ask and you know, how to have these really real conversations very quickly. And then I ended up reaching out to other students. I was involved in some anti-bullying prevention or some bullying prevention work with some national organizations at the time. And so reached out to them and asked if they had any contacts in Minnesota they knew that would be interested in speaking. And that's how I connected with more of the students that are in the film. And it's interesting because the initial film was focused on parents and educators and students. And I had sort of a rough cut of the film, and I sat down and watched it, and I was like, students are going to tune out the moment they hear an adult talking to them about these issues, because for bullying prevention specifically, it's something that's a real student issue. So I ended up having to go and cut out a lot of the adults I had filmed, which had some really awesome interviews, but I realized the strength was in the stories of the students and of the youth in the film.
Right. And what, so to that end, what vision did that give you to dealing with bullying? And I want to preface this by saying the area of Minnesota that you come from and where this all took place has had a pretty notorious reputation, having a higher than normal incidence of teen suicide. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm the district I grew up in is the largest school district in Minnesota, or the largest county in Minnesota. And part of that county, the Anoka, I'm part of the Anoka-Hennepin, or the Hennepin County, but the Anoka-Hennepin County actually made national news. They were profiled in a Rolling Stone article. They had a suicide epidemic, as it was called at the time, because they had, a number of students take their lives within the year period. So it was a really serious issue. Nobody in the state was really talking about it until it made national press, and then they were like, maybe we should discuss this. I mean, once it gets negative national attention, maybe we should address it. So it was something that all the students knew was going on, and all the students were very aware of who were being bullied. And I think that's, you know, that was almost the power of the film in that moment was, you know, having it be students saying, we've had enough of this. These are our stories, and we need you to listen to us because we're suffering here, and nobody's doing anything about it.
And what were some of the interviews that you had for that you personally were sitting there going, wow, as you were hearing them, ones that may have not even made the film? I mean, what did you hear?
Yeah, I think, I mean, all of them, everyone brought their own power and their own strength and their own truth. And I was blown away by the authenticity of everyone who was sharing. I think the hardest interview for me to sit through was the interview with Brittany. Her younger sister was 13 and she committed suicide because of bullying at her school. And that interview was done only a couple weeks after that had occurred. And so it was still very fresh. It was still very real. And it was interesting because the people at the school were actually sending her family a lot of negative things about her sister. So it was a still ongoing process with the school and dealing with all of that harassment. And that was an interview I ended up having to, it was about an hour and a half away from where I lived, and I had to pull over on the side of the road on my way home, and I just bawled for like an hour.
Oh my God.
I just had to collect myself, and it was just so powerful. So.
Yeah. And you feel it in the film when you watch that. What did you learn for yourself in that process as you were, I mean, because it's not even just like you were observing. I mean, you were there and feeling through the whole thing. What did you walk away with from it personally?
I think I grew in many ways during that experience. I think the biggest thing I took away from it was the power of using your voice to empower others, using your truth and speaking out about your experiences, whatever they may be, because those are valid and they're worth hearing. I think that a lot of the students felt silenced, and being able to give them a platform to use their voices, I think, changed me in many ways moving forward, not only in how I saw the world, but also in how I saw what I wanted to do in the world and the work I was being called to do. So I think the biggest growth that I experienced was realizing that I wanted to help people share their truths and to have their voices be given platforms. And so a lot of my work since then has circulated around empowering people who have been silenced and making sure their voices are heard and making sure they're represented and have a spot at the table to share their voices and to make their stories, have an impact in the world.
Right. And we'll come back to Minnesota Nights and some of your experiences around that film, but I want to jump up to your current project that you've got planned and that you're kind of in campaign fundraising mode and adjusting that. What is the original vision of Generation Q?
Yeah, Generation Q is, I guess it's film production, is a docuseries that focuses on the emerging generation of queer folks who are redefining what it means to be young, to be an activist, to be an advocate for the queer rights movement. I think that we are experiencing as young queer people right now a lot of change, a lot of new representation, and a lot of new voices coming to the table that haven't been heard or given a platform in a very long time, if ever even. And I think especially with what we're seeing now politically, with what we're seeing in the world even, I think it's incredibly important to share those voices and to give them platforms. And so the docuseries originally was 5 to 6 young people who were going to share their stories and follow them throughout an experience they were going through. And so that has since pivoted a bit since we didn't get the funding with the original crowdfunding. But I'm really excited because now I have to be more strategic about it, and I have to be, you know, whittle it down to make sure the essence of what I wanted to do is really strong there. And so, yeah, I'm excited. It's still in production and we're still looking for funding sources, but yeah, I'm looking forward to continuing it.
Yeah. So I'll go into a little bit of the stories themselves and the people involved that, you know, what is the unique perspective that the Generation Q activist has today versus other, you know, LGBTQ activists?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's an important question because the project isn't meant to say that anyone else who's not in this current generation of young queer folks, their stories aren't important. That's not the point of it. That's not the essence of it. I think that it's meant to focus on telling the stories of these younger people who are growing up in a time and are sort of finally finding their voices in a time where we're seeing, you know, a record number of young people coming out at a younger age. We're seeing, you know, being gay, being lesbian, being bi, being trans, being accepted and being okay in high schools and, you know, having that opportunity to explore who you are and to find who you are at such a young age. I don't think we've ever seen something like that in such a mass amount before in history, in the United States at least. And so it's a very different time, I think, and highlighting what those experiences look like and what those experiences are, that I think is what the project aims to capture. And to show that, you know, these are the modern young queer experiences of young queer people, and this is how they're changing the world using their experiences.
No, I think that is vitally important, and I love how you just framed that because it is fascinating. And from somebody who's coming to it from my perspective, where, you know, I lived through, you know, I was very young at the time, but the coming out, then the AIDS crisis and everything that happened there with the Ronald Reagan years, which was completely oppressive. And, you know, gay people were roundly demonized in ways that now would be shocking in retrospect. Mm-hmm. You know, gay marriage was not even the least bit imagined. I mean, in anybody's mind, it was the least pressing for gay people or obviously for straight society. You know, and we've, you know, the world has changed so dramatically, but I hear what you're saying because I have 2 14-year-old sons and I am amazed. I was talking to my one son who, you know, about his friends and one of their mutual acquaintances and, one girl in his group, that he was raised with that I've known since she was a baby. And, she's basically just come out as what she calls bi-romantic because she's not sexually active. So she doesn't feel comfortable calling herself bisexual, but she knows mm-hmm. who she is. So she's defined herself as bi-romantic. And he is interested in a girl who just broke up with her girlfriend. And he's got another friend who's transgender. And I was asking him about his transgender friend. I said, you know, well, what pronouns does your transgender friend want to go by? And he goes, I'm not really sure. We don't really talk about it. It's just, I mean, it was just so like what are you talking about? It's just, we just hang out and we just are, we don't worry about things like that. You know, there was such a naturalism about the whole thing where, you know, that's blows my mind, you know, it's, and my son's having a gay dad is completely a non-issue for people. It just, you know, it's like, okay, so what? Big deal. So understanding what, these kids are, who they are and their perspective without that baggage is fascinating. Now, how, for you personally though, do you have a juxtaposition? I mean, cause you're pretty much at that age yourself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think my own experiences impact the way I would represent the stories. That's also the importance of it, is that it is a docuseries about young queer people by young queer people, you know?
Right. No, absolutely. I guess my question was, are you as the filmmaker coming in with the juxtaposition of some sort of, you know, throwing up against what was, and the expectations of before, or are you really just boiling it down? It's like, from the core, this is who we are, and you get to throw us up against that on your own, but we're not trying to juxtapose any of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes down a lot to editing and what the final product will end up looking like once we've got the footage. But I think going into it, it wasn't my intention to juxtapose the old versus the new or to, you know, compare in any sense. I think the comparison will mainly be done by the visualization of the stories and just seeing them as they are authentically. And that's really important to me, is telling the stories and giving them the space to shine in their own way that's authentic to those people. So I think at least the plan is right now just to focus on the stories themselves. And if part of that person's journey involves a comparison with old versus new, or with, you know, more traditional mindsets in terms of conservative views on marriage or anything like that, then I think those will come up and be discussed as we go along. But I think that's going to be dependent on the specific stories we're working with.
Right. Right. So what, have you filmed already part of this, or is this, I mean, I imagine some of your process is going into this with kind of all the elements lined up, but not quite sure what is really going to come out when you start rolling the cameras.
Yeah, for the most part, right now we filmed one of our subjects ran for state office in Minnesota. She's an openly lesbian woman, and we filmed her campaign and the night of the election, all of that, the emotions and the tension there, you know, against the national election and how everyone was feeling in the room there. We also have filmed some of another subject who's based in the Twin Cities, who is a young trans artist who's also dealing with freshman year in college and all those changes and differences there with college instead of high school. From what it looks like now in terms of just the funding issues that we've run into, the project may pivot for the first season or the pilot season to be Midwest specific.
Right.
That might be one of the constraints that we have to work with. But we do have about 1.5 episodes filmed at the moment. So the funding was mainly to get out to the East and West Coast and to Florida to be able to film those subjects. But right now it looks like we're still going to move forward with some of the people who are located in Minnesota and the area of the Midwest around Minnesota, for the time being at least.
Right. Are you anticipating seeing much of a difference in the perspective of kids on the West Coast or Florida versus the Midwest?
I think we may. I think that, I mean, Minneapolis is jokingly referred to as a liberal bubble of the Midwest. I mean, it's pretty pretty liberal here. So I think there will be differences. I think there will be a lot more similarities that we'll see besides the differences. I think some of the struggles we might see will be paralleled, but will just shift a little bit. From what I've experienced, though, and from the people I've talked to, I think the same issues come up in a lot of young queer people's lives, LGBTQ, homelessness, you know, lack of support for safe sex and for education around sex education. And then, you know, so many other issues that I think those run parallel in the young queer experience as it is right now. So you see those wherever you are, but I think that, I think there may be. And a few of the subjects actually who are on the East and West Coast originated from areas in the Midwest and are now doing their work on the coasts. Some are native to those places, but some have also moved out there as well. So I think that's an interesting perspective as well, as having a young person from the Midwest come out to a coast and, you know, how is their experience different, or how do they perceive it to be different because they're now on the coast?
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating because, and the part of the reason I'm saying that is where I live personally is in Santa Cruz. And I don't know if you're familiar at all with the Santa Cruz area in California at all and what happens here. But we are kind of a little bit of a progressive enclave, even for the rest of the state of California. When the original marriage equality, or it wasn't marriage equality, it was when they originally were voting to take away, you know, marriage rights from gay people before they had even voted to give us marriage rights. Santa Cruz County was the only county in the state that voted against it. And then when Prop 8 came through, and of course it passed in the whole state of California, it was defeated by a 99% margin in Santa Cruz County.
Wow.
And to give you a perspective on what we're talking about in terms of Generation Q, we have had an event in Santa Cruz County called the Queer Youth Leadership Awards that goes around it each year. It's held at a different high school in the county, and it awards the top, you know, queer youth of the county and their accomplishments. And it just had its 20th year anniversary of that being done. And every school in the area has, they have GSAs. Most of them have what they call QSAs, because that generation, and this is a little bit departure from my perspective, but because I'm of the old school where I still have not rekindled the word queer for myself. But the younger generation here has, and so they have the queer and straight alliance groups in the high school. So that's the environment that is Santa Cruz, and you know, the culture here, there's still homophobia and there's still pockets of that stuff going on. But, you know, we're statewide, we're in a state that, you know, we were the extra millions that voted for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. And, you know, and in Santa Cruz specifically, you know, the queer culture is very much ingrained into the total culture. So anyway, that long-winded way of saying it actually might be a good juxtaposition, because I don't know how that does compare to even like a liberal enclave in the Midwest.
Yeah, I think it has its similarities and differences, like I said earlier. I mean, I think Minneapolis has been fairly progressive. From my account, we were, throughout the election, it was very pro-Bernie city. The queer community here is very large. In fact, gets rated consistently one of the best places to live for LGBTQ people. I think it's interesting, too, is addressing that, you know, the word queer has changed so dramatically in even the last 5 years. And that's, you know, so that's something my parents are uncomfortable with me saying at times because, you know, it brings them back to, you know, when that wasn't insulting, that was, you know, something
right.
that was a dirty word. So I think that's fascinating in itself is how that has almost been redefined by LGBTQ people. I would argue in the last 5 years, 10 years, I think that shows just how rapidly things are changing. And I think that, you know, restates the importance of looking at why is that? Why is there such a push from folks to rebrand that and to make it something positive?
Right. Well, no, and I think you have a great point with that because I think that I agree with you. It's been really the last 5 years of a really common usage of it in that way where people, you know, used it with great comfort. In the 80s is when it was, you know, a group grabbed it as a almost a countercultural message, you know, because we were in the thick of the AIDS mm-hmm. crisis and we had government that was really ignoring us. I mean, unprecedentedly ignoring a health crisis in a way that, you know, is never done ever. I mean, we have like these mm-hmm. flu things and the, you know, the West Nile virus or whatever, and everybody freaks out because five people, you know, feel bad, you know, and nobody dies. And here we had hundreds of thousands of people dying and the president wouldn't even say the word. You know, so it was the mood of the LGBT community at the time was, you know, under siege. I mean, it was wartime. We were at war. And a group decided at that point that they were going to reclaim the word queer because it was at that time very commonly used to slur us and put us down and hurt us and that type of thing. And you know, it was a conscious decision, not really, you know, I can't say emotionally embraced. It was more, like I said, countercultural. But to your point, in the last 5 years, we have young people who did not live through that. That's ancient history. It was before their time. They didn't experience it. And they have adopted the word queer as a take back, but they have kind of the advantage. And they, I mean, I don't mean to be like talking about you in front of you, but it is a, you know, it's a reclaiming of it, but in earnest. I mean, in a, you know, like, hey, this, yeah, I can own this word and I can, you know, I can fill it out and be it and be comfortable and be proud of it. Where, you know, and that's where a lot of the people who are in my, I hate to age myself, you know, that have gone through what I've gone through, where I will never, mm-hmm. ever be able to do that. But I look at
yeah.
the young people do with respect, you know, and somewhat of in awe. And it, but to me, it's the microcosm of exactly what you're talking about in that, you know, that's an example. It's a word and it's sort of a, you know, external cover. But what is the depth behind that? You know, of the young person's experience in today's age where, you know, diversity is far more accepted and honored and cherished, where in my age it was demonized, vilified, hated, loathed, you know, I mean, in the worst possible ways. So mm-hmm. I don't know if I have a question in there, but what would your comment on that be?
Yeah, I think, too, it's interesting because right now we're seeing such a vast array of representation in terms of what it means to be in our community acronym that, you know, there really aren't enough letters to encapsulate every aspect of that experience for people. And so I think the word queer as reclaimed as it has been, I think it also is the driving force behind it is that it really defines a generation of people who are so beyond LGBT in so many ways, and I think it's become a very complex construct that I think has baffled a lot of people, but is something that's empowering for many others, is that identity doesn't have to be tied down to gender binary. It doesn't have to be tied down to, you know, if you're gay or lesbian and or bi, and there are so many other spectrums between those. And I think that has been one of the driving factors behind it, is that there's really no other word that I've found as a young person that helps, I guess, represent all of those together in one space. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think another thing too is to give credit to a lot of the young people who are from minority backgrounds, in addition to their LGBTQ background, pushed forward in terms of the underground queer movement. A lot of the change that we've seen mainstream-wise has come from a lot of the work that they've done and a lot of the sacrifices that they've made. And I think attention is not given to those stories as often. I think, you know, as a white gay male, it can be easy to sort of be the face of a movement or be, you know, plastered as like, this is what gay is. And I think oftentimes we lose track too of the complexities that are the younger generation. You know, we are all races, we are all ethnicities, we are all backgrounds, right. We are all, you know, so many things. And I think all of that also ties in with the use of that word.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. In fact, I think it's the thing that you touched on, and I think this is, if you go away from words and, you know, semantics, the real thing that I hear from younger people that is breaking through on a whole new perspective of gender identity and sexuality is the recognition of fluidity and the recognition of the non-binary. I mean, that is, that was a given even for gay people, you know, it was, you know, and it led to gay people and straight people. I mean, society people not really being able to accept bisexual people because they always were categorized as being in flux to somewhere else, you know, not that, you know, that is them, that is their identity. And, you know, studies, they've had multiple studies out in the past few years over essentially what we could call Generation Q, where, you know, each of the studies had a different focal group. So it's like, I can't line this up with one overriding statistic, but in an attempt to try to do that, essentially came down to the observation that over 30% of that generation is identifying as something other than heterosexual, which means that, you know, it's bringing us closer to the Kinsey research that was done, you know, end of the 50s, early 60s, that had that kind of, you know, bell graph that showed that there are people on one end of the spectrum and people on the other end of the spectrum, but the vast majority in the middle were not going to be that easy binary. And we're seeing that being experienced now from this younger generation, is, I guess, my observation. I mean, is that, would you characterize that as being part of the core of that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, too, there's also an exploration with that. I just saw last year, I saw sort of a graph of, so you have the Kinsey scale, but then you also have a graph going the other way that's then level of sexual appetite, or not appetite, but I don't know the right word for it, and I apologize for that, but in terms of how sexually active you are and how you feel more romantic or more sexual in relationships, and that construct as well incorporated with the Kinsey scale to make it more complex and fleshed out. there's just so many new things that have always existed but haven't really been accepted or embraced by the communities mainstream-wise that I think are finally starting to be recognized. And I think it's really going to change how we talk about everything.
Tie into the point you just made, you know, when you layer that complexity of, you know, sexual proclivity or appetite or, you know, drive or whatever, you know, perspective that is, then there's a whole other perspective of gender identity, which we are now seeing differentiated from sexual orientation, you know, because, you know, the perspective was that they were very closely tied, you know, and I think the untying of that has actually led to a lot of people understanding their own transgender natures within themselves when it got uncoupled with deciding, you know, which way their, you know, their instincts went in terms of their sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's another piece of the project. So we have the docuseries portion. I'm also working on building a website where people can post their experiences and they can share authentically their stories in written form, or if they want to submit a video, they can do that as well. But I think it's important that even if I can't reach them, we share those stories so that, you know, everyone's represented who is experiencing you know, their identity as someone who's nonconforming to gender binaries, or, you know, someone who is but may be experiencing, you know, a plethora of other experiences that are authentic to them in terms of sexuality or expression or what have you. And I think having a space where all of those can come together and people can bond and read and learn more about other people their age or maybe not their age, but to have those stories all in one space, that's another piece of the project that I think will be very vital moving forward as well. To have that sort of collection of stories and experiences that people can educate themselves and can hear the actual, you know, authentic stories of young queer people.
As you've moved through this process with your target people that you already are talking to and that are inspiring you, what are some of the things that are actually surprising you at this point?
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if it would be necessarily a surprise, but I'm overjoyed with the enthusiasm that people are showing for what this represents. I think I've seen a lot of folks who are really passionate about sharing their story and their truth with the project and with me. They're really excited about people learning more about all the different ways that people are experiencing what queer means as a young person, and how that's showing up in their lives and how they're reshaping certain constructs in different professions and hosting conversations in places where 10 years ago you could be fired and in some places you can still be fired for doing that.
Right.
And what that looks like and how they're, you know, how they're navigating that coming into college and graduating and now as a young professional, what that looks like, and the communities that they're forming with other young people who are going through the same thing. So I think that's something that has really resonated, is just the excitement and the passion behind people wanting to share that and wanting to connect in a space together about that. That's something that I'm really excited about that I've seen consistently, is people being very excited to take part in that.
No, that's really cool. I've got kind of a weird question for you on this. What do you anticipate or maybe are hearing in terms of a cultural perspective from the population of Generation Q in terms of in the old days? And I'm not even going to say that I even embrace this, because I don't necessarily, for me personally, but there was a perception of gayness and gay culture and, you know, in terms of style and fashion and male beefcake and, you know, drag queens and, you know, fabulousness and camp and, you know, and on the lesbian side, you know, sort of, you know, these characteristics that you know, a lot of times, you know, I think a lot of them are seen now as more cliche than gay culture than they were. But what is the mm-hmm. perspective on that kind of culture, and what do you think the new Gen Q cultural effect will be?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it right now. I think we're seeing it in the fashion industry is, in what the entertainment industry is becoming, in the conversations that are being had across those platforms. I think we're seeing it in some of the more mainstream trends. I think a lot of times, unfortunately, I think gay culture specifically appropriates a lot of things from other minority cultures, and because it's then gay culture, people love it and are obsessed with it, and it becomes popular and mainstream. So I think we're seeing a lot of that appropriation, and what does that look like, and how can we lessen the appropriation there and more of the collaboration? But I think I don't know how involved you are in terms of how much you pay attention to sort of the underground art movements and the more, I would say, underground movements in general. A lot of those are being led by younger queer folks. And I think right now we're just seeing the tip of what that means. And I think that in the next 10 years, our society is going to be vastly different in terms of how we view queer people and how we see them as forces to be reckoned with in aspects of the world. I think there's some really amazing things happening right now. I think a lot of people who are very openly queer and LGBTQ are becoming leaders in their fields and are taking those positions as open young professionals. So I think right now it's hard to say exactly how that's turning out, other than new conversations and new advertisements and new ways of talking about things. But I think we're going to see the real implications of that in the next upcoming years based on everything that's happening right now.
No, I totally agree. In fact, that was where I was coming from, because I have seen that work, and I have seen, you know, a lot of those expressions, and I find them not of those cliches at all. I mean, I don't find mm-hmm. them, you know, the male oriented queer, you know, voice or output is not, you know, a feminine, you know, expression. It is unique. It's mm-hmm. human. It's, you know, it's multidimensional, and you know, it's almost like when men came out at my age, the first thing that the first freedom that we tended to do, not necessarily we, but men tended to fall into, because they walked away from, I'm going to be afraid of being who I am, was to mm-hmm. embrace, you know, a female cliche. You know, it was, mm-hmm. you know, from idolizing, you know, strong female role models to, you know, playing with drag to doing all these different things, mm-hmm. because we were so oppressed to not do that. And, you know, we lived our lives with the fear that we might indicate something feminine and be found out. And so it was a very mm-hmm. freeing activity. And I don't see that happening with the Gen Q people.
Yeah. And I think even with that is, I mean, you even look at something like drag and how radically it's been transformed in the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, you have drag is not at all what it used to be. Even 10 years ago, and you look at, you know, there's more shock queens who do shock factor things. You do show queens. You have show queens who are, you know, performing and doing pageants. You have the edgier queens who are pushing the limits of what gender expression can be and would be as a drag queen. And, I mean, that has become its own subculture within gay culture, and gay culture has become its own subculture in queer culture now. So I think the complexities are so rapidly expanding right now that, I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but it's so rapidly expanding that I think it's hard to anymore say, like, this is specifically gay culture or this is specifically queer culture, because I think it means so many things right now, which is amazing that it's able to do that.
Right. Right.
So I think it's, I think that's something that's interesting as well. That's definitely changed.
Yeah, no, I think there's, I think the, a lot of the inroads and these are things that I think for the Gen Q generation that is, for example, you know, there are kids now, I mean, it's fairly new. So, you know, a lot of the people who are probably in the Gen Q space itself, this is not necessarily true from, but it's probably going to be true for my son's generation, you know, whether that's Gen Q one removed or whatever, where the novelty of, you know, same-sex marriage is going to be so commonplace and so integrated. So, you know, it's just marriage. It's just parenthood. It's just, and, right. you know, it's just part of the queer tree, where before it was way over there, you know, and we were assimilating if we tried to do it, because it wasn't ours, it was theirs. And now it's ours. If we choose, you know, it's not, you know, even a mandatory, it's a, you know, one of our life options, where before it wasn't even an option.
Yeah.
I mean, did that make sense or is that?
Yeah, it did. I'm just like basking in that, in what that means, you know?
Yeah. I'm looking at it from the other direction, because I fought so hard for it, and I fought for it, quite frankly, not really for myself. You know, it's like, I'm not really looking for my gay marriage, but I fought for it for Gen Q. I mean, it's like, it's, you know, that was the mantra through it all, was to pass these freedoms and this ability and this right to assume that you get to have that no matter what, to this generation and future generations. And it's interesting.
Yeah.
It is interesting to see, okay, so then what happens with people when that is an assumption and not, you know, they no longer see it as some withheld privilege.
I think that, I think the first thing that pops into my mind when you said that is, I think we're also seeing a lot of, I think we're seeing a lot of underappreciation for the people who fought for it. I don't know if that's been your experience at all, but I know that I've heard multiple people speak out against the younger generation not really paying attention or paying respect to the people who came before, who, you know, were fighting for their lives to have that be a reality. I think it's interesting too that now that is sort of a new reality of specifically the U.S. What other issues then are able to be focused on if that becomes the reality? So, you know, now if it's just marriage, then how do we tackle conversion therapy, and how can we tackle, you know, youth homelessness in the LGBTQ population?
Right.
Whereas I think before, it was hard to focus on all of those things. And so it was like, okay, we have to get marriage equality. We have to get, you know,
don't ask, don't tell,
that sort
yeah.
of stuff. And
yeah.
Exactly. So it's like, if that becomes commonplace, then how much more can we focus on, you know, some of those issues that were maybe put on the back burner because
I don't know if I would say it's a back burner. It's sort of a hierarchy, because, you know, don't ask, don't tell. It's like when you have a society that now says, okay, this group of people get to serve for, you know, their military, and they get to be honored with their, then you turn and go, well, but we can't let people who are now going to die for their country with honor, tell them they can't get married. You know, it's like that next rites just seems sort of natural to come next. And, and everything you're mentioning, I mean, the teen homelessness, I have to say, is a almost a horrific byproduct of the well-intentioned activism of my generation, because what we've done is we've inspired the Gen Q people to own who they are, be who they are, and when they come out, they're in environments where their parents are not with them. They haven't caught up. They're not there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, that situation is dangerous. And so we've mm-hmm. increased that incident where, had we stayed in our own little closets and left them in their own little closets, they would have had the safety to ride through until they left home. I mean, it's, you know, I'm way oversimplifying it, but I think there is an effect. That's why, for me personally, the fact that that 40% of homeless teens are LGBT kids, you know, way out of proportion of what it should be, you know, mm-hmm. per head capita, I take responsibility for that. That's my issue. You know, I have to help solve that, because, you know, my generation helped inspire that to have happened. So, you know, and reparative therapy is torture for kids. I mean, there are a lot of incredibly important things. So, Alex, mm-hmm. This may come to a shock, but we've only got like 3 minutes left here.
Oh my gosh.
We give good ratings.
Time has flown by.
So, let's wrap up. What can people do to help Generation Q come to be reality?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, if anyone is interested in sharing their experience or knows someone who would be interested in sharing their experience, I think we can possibly post a link to my Facebook or my email, but you can email alec.fisher, alec.fisher@films@gmail.com. I'm hoping to get
we'll
in contact
put that
with
up
more
on,
people.
We'll put that up in the Rated LGBT Radio group. I'll post it on the Evol Equals Facebook page, and we'll put that around. So we'll put a package of contact information for you on all the PR places. So definitely.
Yeah, you can also reach out on Facebook, Alec Fisher. I think it's Alec Fisher 3 or something is the Facebook handle for my profile. But you can shoot me a message there if that's easiest for you. And then also, for longevity's sake, if anyone knows of anyone who is interested in financing projects that are bringing young LGBTQ voices to the forefront of conversations, I would love to get in touch with you and have a further conversation about how you could assist the project moving forward. So that's another plug there.
That's
same contact.
And what age group, Alec, what age group are you looking for the interviews? Like what age range would fit into the Gen Q demographic?
Yeah, that is a good question. So this is going to be sort of an elongated, broadened generation. But we're looking essentially for any voices or stories of folks who are between 14 and 15 to early 30s. So 15-year gap or so in there. And, yeah, I mean, wherever you fall in that realm, even if you're younger or older, we still are interested in hearing your story. But that's like the primary sector that we're looking at.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight. And Alec is going to also be joining me on a future episode of Out in Santa Cruz. So make sure you pay attention and follow us there and look for that show, because we will continue this conversation and cover different aspects we probably forgot tonight. And I'm very excited, Alec. And I wanted one thing that for a future conversation, I want to hear about your experience on promoting Minnesota, your Minnesota film. It was huge. Anyway, you've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Listen again next week. I'm Rob Watson, and have a great night, everyone.